Well, the things I'll be talking about today will be the music of the Catholic Church, right up to and including Luther's first hymn. Tomorrow will be the effect of Luther's hymns and the reading of many of the hymns that aren't included in the hymnal. The next day will be whether or not Luther wrote the hymns, which will be a question you'll all have to decide pretty much for yourself. I can give you the musical background of the question, but it's a really interesting problem. And the last day will sort of be an open discussion thing on hymns in general. Why we sing hymns, why is it that the first people who sang them decided they wanted them sung instead of read? And is the hymnal still of any use? These sort of questions. I think, as far as musical history goes, no period interests me anywhere near as much as this one, because at no time in the history of man has music exerted the political, social, economic, every sort of influence, cultural influence, to a tremendous degree that music played during the time of the Reformation, and particularly the music of Martin Luther. When I was in Germany, I was really lucky in being allowed into the archives of the Museum of Musical Instruments, which has a huge library on music history. And one of the first books that I got to see was this collection by a man named Bachernagel of German hymns. And he lists 1,448 hymns composed between 868 and 1518. So these are hymns prior to Luther. Now, some of them are only hymns in a qualified sense, being that they were only used for private use. You see in a lot of medieval pictures, things like that, people at prayer, often you'll see the Bible open. Next to that, you'll see a book with notes in it, their own private songbook, which is an extremely expensive item to have, because they would be each hymn individually produced for you. Usually they'd glorify you in some way, mention you by name in association with your patron saint. Down to the 10th century, there really isn't anything that we can call a church hymn. The very first sort of hymn, and by hymn I mean something that would be sung in general by the congregation at a service, was the Kyrie Eleison. This was used in pilgrimages, processions, burial of the dead, greeting of important visitors. The people were required to repeat it many times, usually about 200 times in succession, because singing at this time was strictly a detail of the sacred office. It wasn't something that you did at church. The only place where you would be allowed to use it would be in these sort of minor religious functions. And they included as a minor religious function Vespers. And why is it that you suppose they allowed them to sing at Vespers? How many people do you think, how many peasants, after working all day, went to Vespers? Not many. And also there's an idea still held to by the Catholic Church involved in this, and that's the idea of grace. There are three kinds of grace in the Catholic Church. You get sanctifying grace, which you receive by going to the sacraments, of which there are seven in the Catholic Church: marriage, extreme unction, which is the last sacrament, communion, confirmation, holy orders, and there's two more, baptism and penance. And for those you get sanctifying grace. Actual grace is a free gift of God. Infused grace is also called practical grace. It's something you get for good works, and these good works have to be connected with the church. In other words, if you sing in the choir, if you play the organ at church, if you're an altar boy, if you're one of the ladies who cleans the altar or dusts icons or something like that, then you get this type of grace. And this separates the singing, makes it much more of a sacred office. Song up to this time, like prayer, which is sort of an interesting thing, was discouraged. They talked of prayer, but prayer was discouraged. This sort of communion with God was not really looked upon as something good. although everyone did pray. It was usually in the form, the accepted form of the church. It wasn't the sort of prayer where you would speak what was on your mind. It was, you would repeat a certain number of novenas to Mary, something in that order. These songs, then, that people sang at this time came to be known as Kyrlaisen or Lysen, because the choir eventually took over and added stanzas in these songs. They would sing the first Kyrlaisen, and then they would sing maybe two verses of dealing with something, maybe the long life of the monarch or something like this, or the glories of Mary. And then the people would join in on the Kyrlaisen on the end. And the reason that this was shortened to the word Lysen was because, imagine having to learn this. I have a copy of the same one that was used then, which is still used in the church at High Mass. So I'm going to try to sing, give you an idea of how difficult it is. The whole thing lasts about 15 minutes.
Oh.
It goes... Eleison, Christe, Eleison. Imagine trying to learn that and singing it at the end. The reason that these things were forbidden, and that this was the only expression allowed to the people. And it's important to remember that this wasn't at the Mass, only at something like a vestige or a burial, was because the church realized what it meant when you sang. There's a very subtle distinction there, because when you sing, to a greater extent, it makes the liturgy part of your own creation. It gives you an active role in the service. And this is very contrary to the basic tenet of the church, that the Mass is said for you and not through you. And that's very important in everything that I'm going to be talking about. Remember that the Mass does not need to be said in your presence. You know, you often will hear the phrase, when someone dies who is a Catholic, they're having a Mass said for him. It has nothing to do with you, particularly. It's something that's done for you. It's a gift made to you by the sacred office. Also, there's a constant suspicion, or was, on the part of the authorities, that the singing of these hymns, or of any hymns, would be a means for some sort of subtle intrusion of unchurchly ideas. That this would be a means for them to enter. And it also would lower the sanctity of the priesthood. Imagine a Gothic cathedral, you know, whatever, and all of a sudden you have, you know, the congregation singing. In other words, putting them on the same level as the priest. In the 13th century, the church sort of grudgingly had to ease up on these rules. And I do mean grudgingly. The Crusades, court epic poems, Meister singers, things like this. Singing became quite popular, very popular. And particularly at this time, under this sort of stimulus of nightly devotion, in comes Mary. And singing just comes out in ecstatic lyrics, like crazy. The multiplication of tunes is unbelievable at that time. This book lists very few up till about the 13th century, and then just almost everyone has something to do with Mary. And this was something long cherished by the authorities of the church, and then finally, you know, the people just picked this up. And imagine what this would do to you. How would this, do you think, affect you if you were, say, you know, take the extreme example of Yana Peasant. All of a sudden, you too are capable of refined feeling. You too are a gentleman. You too can adore Mary. Mystics in the 14th century, like Eckhart, started writing hymns in this new tone, this sort of joy in the personal love with the Redeemer, a very intimate relationship. And who do you suppose enjoyed this the most? you know, what religious order? The sisters, you know, who are singing these day and night. Which is one reason that Luther said at one point that he didn't call a choir of 12 nuns singing "O Salutaris Hostia" music. He called it a chicken coop at sunrise. Also, in the 14th century, a very important development takes place in that adaptation of two religious poems of secular ditties and religious paraphrases in general. A good example is "Den liebsten Buhlen, den ich han," which means "my beautiful sex organ which I do cherish" becomes "the beautiful Savior who I do cherish." And this, if you saw the Wesley hymn, is very effective. There's a terrific scene in there where he suddenly says, "Well, we'll put words to the music, you know, the drinking songs," and then you have everybody singing them immediately. Then the 15th century comes along, and the church comes down harder than ever before, and particularly with the inflexible insistence on the use of Latin. Absolutely refuses now even to let the people sing the Lesen in church, which was a very popular thing, even though very difficult. You would sing it sort of like "Lesen," you know, at the end. You know, that you knew. You know, you knew where that came. That was the easy part. And of course, though, it's being more and more confined to a group of low clerical officials. And this part of the century is the time full of premonition, the sort of end of the 15th century, where the Jewish population was already predicting the end of the world, I think about a third of the way through 1532 or something like that. The revival of learning is shaking up Germany. All the strong political and religious movements begun in Bohemia and Moravia by Huss and his martyrdom, these things are all having a terrific effect. He was attacking many of the abuses that were already bothering Luther. And at this time, all over, there was a great call for the vernacular in the church. And in terms of the hymns that we'll be discussing tomorrow, remember that at first Luther did not want the vernacular in the church. He wanted it only in some services, not in all. You know, he wrote many times that he would, that the service was in, or that the service was in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, and he thought it a very good thing that all should know this. And then I think it was the very same year he said that he composed the German Mass. Huss was also the prototype of Luther in the sense that he was the virtual founder of the Bohemian hymn books. He wrote hymns in Latin and Czech, and encouraged the religious use of vernacular songs by the people. The Utraquists religious group published a songbook in Czech in 1501, and the Unitas Fratrum one containing 400 hymns in 1505. And that is important as preceding the first Lutheran songbook by 20 years. So this is important in the sense that, see, the Catholics give Luther nothing. They won't admit that Luther composed any tunes, that he was at all original. The last tune to be dug up, there's been a lot of controversy about whether or not he wrote those tunes. And it took one Monsignor, or this one Jesuit, Italian Jesuit, 20 years to find it. But he did find the Gregorian chant that came from, and then got elevated to Monsignor right away, see, for all his trouble. And many Protestants, on the other hand, I think, assume that Luther was just a musical genius, that all of a sudden this was just snap, you know, a whole new school of hymn writing, you know, where, as we'll see in 2 days, the hymns are that we sing now, like "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," was put that way only about a little under 300 years ago. It was originally sung almost like the Kyrie Eleison that I sang a few minutes ago, only nowhere near that difficult, but in the same sort of mode. The poetry And the texts for these songs came from the Psalms, old Latin songs, Latin hymns. People like the Brethren of Common Life in the Netherlands were requesting the vernacular and using it in their own services, which they'd already established, singing many hymns already. The pre-Reformation hymns, I think, cast a lot of light on the nature of religious belief right before the Reformation. There is such a variety of elements in them. All of this extremely pure, noble sentiment mixed up with unbelievable crass realism and things. And this would come out later in some of Luther's hymns, only to a very slight degree, and that mostly for effect, because the effect of these things is really amazing. But you have things which the Catholic Church was not discouraging, like Mary Created the World. That was very popular in certain parts of Germany for quite a while, that Mary was responsible for this, and that Mary was in fact the mother of God the Father, besides being the mother of God the Son. So the Catholic music was the music and the work of men upon whom this sort of scholastic mind and aesthetic life had worked to refine the concepts down just to the sharpness of the pin. It wasn't the music of the layman, but that of monks and priests, and always contained this image of the never-ending striving for just the tiniest moment of the glimpse of the beatific vision, which was always the goal. Just the tiniest, you know, if you couldn't be so great that you could have the stigmata, the marks of the cross on your hands and feet and side, then perhaps a small portion of heaven would be open to you for a moment. And particularly, you can imagine the writers of texts and hymns, people who are somewhat aesthetically oriented to begin with. It's the poetry and music of the temple, the sacramental mysteries, the hour of prayer, has everything to do with stained glass windows, majestic music, incense, and then imagine yourself as a layman. You're not particularly at home in that atmosphere. The very best you can be is completely awed by it. But a need was soon arising to particularize the religious feeling, to lay hold of something a lot more tangible than this. The first Lutheran hymn, and it's, I think it really qualifies itself as a hymn. It's actually a ballad. It's not at all in the style of a hymn. It's a storyline. Was composed in 1523. Among Luther's most faithful followers were members of his own order, and as early as 1519, Jakob Spreng in the Netherlands at the Augustinian Monastery was supporting his teachings. And as you know, in 1521, the Diet of Worms condemned Luther, but of course the area of Germany that Luther was in wasn't under direct control of the emperor. And so his prince, Friedrich, refused to sign the document and put Luther into protective custody. But in the Netherlands, these lands are directly under the control of the emperor, and the edict was carried out to the letter. And one of the centers of Lutheranism at the time was at the University of Louvain. And the Augustinian monks there were preaching Lutheranism like crazy. So they came and they said, stop that, which they didn't do. So they leveled the monastery and put them all in jail. And then they still refused to recant. And they said, well, we'll give you a choice. You can either all be strung up or you can recant. And they recanted, except for three. And whose names were Lambert Thorne, Johann Esch, and Heinrich Voss. And we don't know what happened to Heinrich Voss. He was imprisoned for quite a while, there's a letter written by Luther to him in 1524, but whatever became of him we don't know. But the other two were burned at the stake in the marketplace at Brussels on July 1st, 1523, and became the very first martyrs of the Reformation. And of course Luther, you can imagine how he felt, was greatly moved by that. But he didn't pity the men, you know, he looked upon it as a great spiritual triumph that they had given this blood witness to the gospel. What made him furious and what made him write to him were the rumors that were quickly spread by the church that at the moment of the death, the two of them had recanted and had taken back and had made their, quote, peace with the church, unquote. So he made use of the mass media of the day. And in an age without radios, television, cables, newspapers, there was nothing that traveled as fast as a song. And that tradition was alive in this country, even still until the end of the last century, the tradition of broadsheets and broadsides, where they would publish a sheet somewhat larger than this with the words on it without the music and pass them out. And in this case, they weren't sold. Usually they were sold for a penny. And the man who sang them would also do the selling. The style of this ballad hymn is dramatic, direct, and very simple. Most of these sort of songs began with the line, "What shall we now take up and sing?" That was almost always the beginning of them. And this one is, "A new song here shall be begun." And Luther was really familiar with this. He'd mastered the lute. There's a story that he sang at inns on the way to the Diet of Worms, at the one in Frankfurt, and that he entertained the guests for a whole evening on the lute with his own song. And I think with the writing of this, almost overnight, Luther became aware of the talent he had as a hymn writer. And this is the only one in the form of the ballad. He was never to use it again, but it was picked up by the Anabaptists, who expounded or elaborated on it and composed some of these with as many as a couple hundred verses, extremely long songs about their own persecution as a religious group. Here is the first Lutheran hymn. "A new song here shall be begun, the Lord God help our singing. Of what our God himself hath done, praise honor to him bringing. At Brussels in the Netherlands, by two boys, martyrs youthful, he showed the wonders of his hands, whom he with favor truthful so richly hath adorned. The first right fitly John was named, so rich he in God's favor. His brother Henry one unblamed, whose salt lost not its savor. From this world they are gone away, the diadem that gained. Honest, like God's good children, they for his word life disdained, and have become his martyrs. The old arch fiend did them immure with terrors, did enwarp them. He bade them God's dear word abjure, with cunning he would trap them. From Louvain many sophists came, in their cursed nets to take them. By him are gathered to the game, the spirit fools doth make them. They could get nothing by it. Oh, they sang sweet and they sang sour. Oh, they tried every double. The boys, they stood as firm as a tower and mocked the sophist's trouble. The ancient foe is filled with hate that he was thus defeated by two such youngsters, he so great, his wrath grew sevenfold heated. He lain his plans to burn them. Their cloister garments off they tore, took off their consecrations. All this the boys were ready for. They said amen with patience. To God their Father they gave thanks that they would soon be rescued from Satan's scoffs and mumming pranks, with which, in falsehood masked, the world he so befooled. Then gracious God did grant to them to pass true priesthood's border and offer up themselves to him and enter Christ's own order. Unto the world to die outright, with falsehood made a schism, to come to heaven all pure and white, to monkery be the besom, and leave men's toys behind them. They wrote for them a paper small, and made them read it over. The parts they showed them therein all, which their belief did cover. Their greatest fault was saying this: in God we should trust solely, for man is always full of lies. We should distrust him wholly. So they must burn to ashes. Two huge great fires they kindled then. The boys were carried to them. Great wonder seized on every man, for with contempt they viewed them. To all with joy they yielded quite, with singing and God-praising. The sophs had little appetite for these new things so dazing, which God was thus revealing. They now repent the deed of blame, would gladly glaze it over. They dare not glory in their shame, the facts almost they cover. In their hearts gnaweth infamy, they to their friends deplore it. The spirit cannot silent be, good Abel's blood outpoured must still besmear Cain's forehead. Leave off their ashes never will, into all lands they scatter. Stream, hole, ditch, grave, naught keeps them still, with shame the foe they spatter. Those whom in life with bloody hand he drove to silence triple, when dead he them to in every land, in tongues of every people, must here go gladly singing. But yet their lies they will not leave, to trim and dress the murder. The fable false which out they gave shows conscience grinds them further. God's holy ones, even after death, they still go on belying. They say that with their latest breath, the boys, in act of dying, repented and recanted. Let them lie on evermore. No refuge so is reared. For us, we thank our God, therefore, his word has reappeared. Even at the door is summer nigh, and winter now is ended. The tender flowers come out and spy. His hand, when once extended, withdraws not till he's finished. Pretty prophetic. Any questions?
This, of course, is written in German.
Yeah.
And of course, it wasn't quite that often.
How
was it?
Well, that's an interesting thing tomorrow, because I've got a good translation of A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. The words that are in the hymnal now are really bad. And Luther's poetry is coarse, to say the least. Very rough.
With a coarse time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
One often justifies some of his rather rash and
Time. Yeah. The funny thing is that his music is so soft. His music is extremely gentle. Like A Mighty Fortress Is Our God was originally sung something like, A Mighty Fortress, and it would go on like that, very smoothly, very Gregorian chant-like. And it was not until the time when people started feeling, gee, they really bashed people around at the Reformation. Those hymns were really tough things, and they were sung extremely fast, much faster than I just sang that one. And cut all of that out to single note lines for ease of singing.
I'd like you again maybe to consider the best translation of what is the fourth stanza of A Mighty Fortress in our hymn book. Just bear with my theory that I have. Without me, it would be reinforced.
There's one here that's fairly accurate German, I think. Yeah. I don't know where.